Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is titled Bill Moyers, The Man and His Myths. Recorded in 1997, Dennis McQuiston, former clinical professor of corporate governance and executive director of the Institute for Excellence in Corporate Governance at the University of Texas at Dallas, and renowned PBS journalist and former White House press secretary Bill Moyers discuss Mr. Moyers' life, his time in the Kennedy and Johnson administrations, and his journalism career. We hope you enjoyed today's episode, and don't forget to subscribe to the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Bill Moyers, two words and a man almost synonymous with PBS. You've seen him interview the great thinkers of our time, explore the great ideas, and you've wondered, just who is Bill Moyers, and why does he do what he does? You're in for a treat, so stay with us. Bill Moyers has been in broadcasting for 25 years and has won dozens of awards, including over 30 Emmys. You've seen him on CBS and PBS, and you've enjoyed his series on politics, education, and the power of myth with Joseph Campbell. His most recent television project is Genesis, A Living Conversation. The president of Columbia University called him, and I quote, a unique voice, still seeking new frontiers in television, daring to assume that viewing audiences are willing to think and learn. Bill, welcome to the program.
My pleasure, Dennis.
The question is, are audiences still willing to think and learn?
Well, there are always exceptions. There's a little town between Dallas and Waco called, I pronounced it Italy, I think the residents pronounce it Italy. And there used to be a sign out there when I drive down to the University of Texas, where I went to the last 2 years of college, and it said, Italy, Texas, home of 600 wonderful people and three old grouches. There are always exceptions, but I think, yes, on the whole, people are willing to learn. I think for most people, life is a continuing course in adult education. And they learn it where they are, and if they have the opportunities, they learn it well, and if they don't have the opportunities, they pick it up as best they can. I was, when I came to Dallas, staying over at the Grand Kempinski Hotel, I went in to have a sandwich one morning, early, 11:30, and I was taken aback by one of the waiters who came over and said, introduced himself and said, Mr. Moyers, I've watched public broadcasting, I've watched what you've done, and he mentioned different shows that I've done and others done. And what he was saying to me was that Channel 13, Channel 2, public broadcasting in the North Texas area are his classroom. He makes minimum wages. He can't afford to go to night school. He can't afford to go to community college. So public broadcasting is the avenue for him.
You've seen that happen. You've been with people in settings on the street, airports. People come up to you. People that you wouldn't normally think of as intellectuals, but people who, regardless of what they do, are actively thinking all the time. And I guess the question that person might want to know is, why do you do what you do? Why do you try to make these things happen? I mean, you've visited with all these thinkers. What are you trying to accomplish?
Well, I'm a journalist, for one thing, and the first editor of the first newspaper in America, published in 1691 in Boston, Massachusetts, put on his masthead that his mandate was to give an account of such considerable things as come to his attention. And that's what we journalists are about. We see something interesting. We want to share it with someone else. We want to report it. And I'm a reporter first and foremost. But I also have an insatiable curiosity myself. I grew up in Marshall with a succession of wonderful English teachers who opened the world of ideas to me. I can still see Selma Brutsey standing in front of the class reading from Byron or Keats or Shelley, assigning me to do my term paper on Walter Lippmann, one of the great journalists of the mid part of this century. Inez Hughes diagramming sentences with her back turned to us with the precision of a drill sergeant, pounding into us the necessity for some internal order of ideas. And I was a good student. I think all of my life I've loved the information that comes in preparing for a test. I hate tests, but I love the research and the preparation. Loved the library. First time I walked into the library at a little library on the east side of Marshall, built by the League of Business and Professional Women in 1926. We didn't have many volumes. It maybe 800, 1,000 volumes. I walked in there and said, wow, all of these they wrote for me. Well, you don't have to be possessive about education that way. So I just, when you get it, you want to share it.
Yeah. The great thing about what you do and what we do in this world of television and education is even if we share it, we still have it. And you still have so much of it because of all the people that you've talked to. How have these conversations over all these years changed you and the way you see the world?
That's hard to answer, because one takes away from an experience what isn't evident at the moment. It may lie like a seed down there, and many years later, unfold and open and respond to an event that you didn't even anticipate. But I've just learned so much from the people that I've been with, the historians who've helped me to connect the past, the philosophers who helped me to connect concepts to the world I live in, other journalists who've taken me on journeys that they've been on. I think that I've learned something from everybody, although it's very hard to diagram that knowledge the way Inez Hughes did and said, I learned this from him or this from you.
When you talk to people and listen to people who have heard you in all these various settings and all the work that you've done, you have some stories, which one of which I heard earlier this year. You were walking down the street, as I recall, in New York, and a lady came up to you. And if you know the story I'm talking about, please tell our viewers about it, because it really got to me, and I think will to that person watching
this. Was this after the Campbell series?
Yes.
Well, you know that I did this series with Joseph Campbell. I did it because I was curious about him as a teacher. He was a great teacher, taught 38 years at Sarah Lawrence College, had spent his whole life integrating the world's knowledge, anthropology, literature, religion, art, dream interpretation into a way of looking at the world, at mythology, at the great stories people in every culture tell themselves to explain their relationship to the universe and to each other. He was a marvelous teacher, and the series ran an instant, great response. It got a small audience at first, but word of mouth spread, and pretty soon television stations were repeating it over and over, so that now some 40 million people have seen it, many of whom have written me about it, and some of whom have talk to me about it. And this particular incident that I think you're referring to happened about a year after the series had aired. I was coming out of the La Caramba restaurant on 8th Avenue between 54th and 55th Street in New York, where I live and work. And I was moving up the street, and a young woman was coming toward me, 31, 32. And you know, television makes us instant, intimate strangers. People think they know you who've just seen you, and you can always tell in the feedback you get from a pair of eyes that there's that glint of recognition. So as we approached each other, we sort of turned and looked at each other. I knew she recognized me, and she thought she recognized me, but wasn't quite sure. And then she said, Mr. Moyers? I said, yes. She was apologetic and shy, but she said, if you have a few minutes, I'll tell you a story. And I said, fine. Let me just back up and say that in my series with Campbell, we talked a lot about the meaning for life. I said to him, you're looking for the meaning of life. He said, no, I'm not looking for the meaning of life. I'm looking for the experience of life. I think most people think that they're looking for the meaning of life, when deep down they're really looking for that inner harmony between their physical being and their spiritual being.
Yeah, and he sort of said, I think about the experience of living, yeah, as opposed to the meaning for life. Yeah. And that was really powerful, because I think it surprised you a bit when he answered that.
Yes, that was a moment of revelation. I was raised to look for the meaning of life, and you know, to defer gratification, and even to not analyze experience, to analyze experience instead of just letting it be. And he was talking about the rapture of the moment, enjoying whatever you're doing or getting something from it. So she said, I came to New York 8 years ago. I wanted to be an actress. I burned to be an actress. She said, I went to all the auditions. The parts always seemed to be fugitive. They went to someone else. I couldn't get a really good part. I had a couple of minor roles and an understudy role once, but nothing ever happened. I fell in love with a man. We lived together for a while. He left me, married another woman within 2 weeks after leaving me. 3 weeks after he left me, my father died. I'm broke. I was broke. I wait tables like so many other young people in New York in order to make ends meet, and I just had enough. One night I came home, that's my apartment right over there, she said. One night I came home and it was enough. And I pulled the window down, lowered the shade, poured a stiff glass of bourbon, turned on the oven, the gas stove in my one-room apartment, and lay down on the couch. And she was really prepared for the curtain to fall, the last curtain. And she said, but I made a mistake. I left my television set on. It'd been on all day, actually, all night. And I'd left early that morning, and I heard a familiar voice, yours, I recognize your voice, and I heard you talking to somebody who was talking about the experience of being alive, the rapture or ecstasy of the moment, the importance of living life now. And she said, it was very interesting. I heard the announcer say, tune in next week and we'll continue the conversation with Joseph Campbell. So she said, you know, I was curious. I was interested. I got up. I turned off the gas. I poured out the bourbon. I lifted the window and the shade and waited. And she said, you know, it was. And then I watched the rest of the series. And she said, what I've realized is I don't have to be an actress, but I really want to experience my life. And she said, I just want to thank Joseph Campbell, wherever he is, for that moment of illumination, for that radiant moment of discovery that came to me totally unexpected when I least was least expecting it, but most prepared for it.
He used that expression, intimate strangers, and she did feel that she knew you, and obviously got to know Joseph Campbell. The difficulty in this medium is because we're sitting here talking to each other, that person watching this program now is with us, and yet we're not really with them. How does it feel to you? What does that sort of an experience do to you when someone comes up to you on the street, maybe not as dramatic as that, but says, here's how this idea helped change my life?
Well, it's very rewarding. It's like a teacher who's been in a classroom all of her life and gets a visit from a former student who comes by and says, you may not know it, Miss Brutsey, but when you read Shelley or when you read Keats or when you read Byron, it opened my ears to the music of that language, and all of my life I have danced to that music. Thank you very much. That's what it is. People don't come up to me and say, oh, you're wonderful or you're a marvelous person. They come up and talk about someone I've had on or some work that I've done. It's not invested with ego. They're not responding to me personally. I'm a rather dry and serious and pleasant but not charismatic person. They're not responding to me as if I were Henry Fonda or Brad Pitt or anyone
like
that.
Hey, you never know.
They're talking to me. Well, I do know because nobody has ever... they're talking to me as if I had been their teacher, right, their uncle who'd got it. And that's yeah, really satisfying.
And I think that's the idea, is when you're a man of ideas, as you are, that's what you're trying to get out. Now, occasionally, I think, it could be that someone could see you out of context, as opposed to being on that little screen. They see you some other place and maybe can't exactly call your name. And I remember a story that you told about being, being mistaken for, wasn't it Charles Kuralt?
Oh, yeah.
Tell that story, if you don't mind.
Well, it happens all the time. My wife and I were out walking on West 75th Street this summer in New York, where we live and where my office is, and I noticed about three-quarters of the way down the block a lady engaged in intense conversation with her neighbor. So that came as she looked up, that instant but faint glimpse of recognition. Who is that? I recognize that person. I got about 5 feet from her, and still looking at me, she said, she stopped a conversation with her neighbor, and she said, do you know who you are? I started to say something, and my wife spoke up and said, he's 60 years old, and he still doesn't know. But anyway, the story you're talking about is I'd flown to Shreveport, Louisiana, which is the airport nearest Marshall, Texas, where I was coming to see my parents. And a lady came up to me and said, oh, I just love your work, Mr. Kuralt. She said, but you look different in person from the way you do on television. And I said, yes, ma'am, on television I'm balder and fatter. And she said, oh, that's all right. I love you both ways. And the point of it is so much for notoriety. Yeah. I mean, fame on television is so fleeting that if you sit comfortably on it, it's like sitting on a cloud. You go right to the bottom.
Let me take you back to some of your earlier days in Texas, and that viewer probably knows that you were going to school up at North Texas, which is in Denton, just north of here, ended up at the University of Texas. And then you had an encounter before you really got to be a journalist with a couple of presidents. One of them was named John Kennedy, the other one Lyndon Johnson. Tell us a bit about those encounters and how that helped shape you in this world of ideas that you've been involved in.
Well, both men drew me into a much larger world than I had been occupying. I mean, the world of government, the world of Washington, was a world stage. And I had been a student in Texas all of my life, 1 year at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland for graduate work. But I had been living, like most of us, in a rather confined and parochial world. And as coincidence and circumstance would have it, I wound up, through no derring do on my part, working for two dynamic presidents. John Kennedy, I knew nothing at the time of all the stories that came out subsequent about his private life, and I don't guess it would have mattered to me very much at that time that I didn't know it, but because he had a way when he spoke of making me think. I remember standing out on the Capitol grounds in that icy January morning when he gave his inaugural address, "Ask not what your country can do for you, but ask what you can do for your country." John Kennedy had a way of making me think I could do more than I thought I myself could do, and of making me want to do more than I felt competent to do. He brought out something in a lot of people that caused us to reach, that enlarged our grasp, enlarged our reach, if not our grasp. And it was in no small part because of him that I wanted to be involved in helping to organize the Peace Corps. I persuaded him and LBJ to let me go. I was the liaison between their two campaigns and connected to both of them. I had a way of talking both to the Irish in Boston and the Texans in Austin. And I had a small but interesting role there. And I went to the Peace Corps. And the Peace Corps, of course, for 3 years, the best 3 years of my life. I helped organize it. I saw Congress. Sergeant Shriver and I called on every member of Congress, 435 members of the House and 100 members of the Senate, to persuade them that they should back this idea. And then I spent 3 years negotiating agreements with governments around the country, recruiting volunteers, promoting the Peace Corps. It was just a liberating experience. Then, of course, I wound up because of the assassination. John Kennedy had called me and asked me to come to Texas. He said I had sent an Italian advance man from Massachusetts down to Texas, and he can't tell the difference between a Connolly and a Yarborough.
And that's quite a difference.
Yeah,
for the person watching this show who didn't know either one of them, there's quite a
sort
difference.
Sort of like the difference between Clinton and a Gingrich.
Yes.
In spite
of the fact that at that time they were both still Democrats.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And the Kennedy camp knew, and President Kennedy knew, that I had a way of talking to both camps. And so he said, go down to Texas and just hold everybody's hand until I leave town. And I said, I really can't do that, Mr. President. I'm the deputy director of the Peace Corps, and we can't involve the Peace Corps in politics. And this was a political trip. He was getting ready for the 1964 campaign against Barry Goldwater. He felt it would be Barry Goldwater, too. He said, no, you let me worry about the Peace Corps, and you go to Texas and worry about politics. So I went down and just was a peacemaker. I just listened to people and carried messages and translated, really, between tribal, warring tribes. And everybody was peaceful. And I was actually having lunch noon on the 22nd of November in Austin at the 40 Acres Club with Frank Irwin, who later became the powerful chairman of the State Democratic Committee. And a waiter came over and said, you're wanted on the phone. I went to the phone, and it was J.C. Kellum, who was the manager of the radio and TV station that LBJ and his wife owned. He said, something's happened in Dallas. I don't know what it is, but something's happened, something bad. So I got on the phone and called. I had the private number for the Secret Service headquarters in Dallas. So I called them, and he said, yes, the president's been shot. So Frank Irwin and I raced out to the airport, chartered a plane and flew to Dallas. We were above Waco when Robert Trout, the CBS announcer, said, ladies and gentlemen, the president of the United States is dead. I landed here in Dallas, got into a police car, and started down to Parkland Hospital. But a dispatcher caught up with us and said, the new president is on Air Force One at Love Field. So I turned around and went back to Love Field, got to the steps. A Secret Service man I didn't know stopped me, because they were stopping everybody. And I wrote a little note and said, Mr. President, I'm here if you need me. So he got the message and called me up. And I went back to New York, to Washington with him, and then stayed 3.5-4 years in the White House. And that, of course, pitched me into a much larger arena. I had a lot more energy than I did wisdom there. I wish I could do it again with the wisdom instead of the energy, but it was a fascinating experience.
Well, one of the things that you've said many times is, and I think it probably happens to almost anybody as they are graduating from college or shortly thereafter, I think you said at that time you knew a lot about things. In the last 30 years or so, you found that you didn't know that much.
You know, like a lot of young people, I went to college to get answers to my questions. And so you study to get particular answers and try to get them down to what today we'd call a soundbite or a bumper sticker. You know, answers the questions. Life's tough questions, here are the answers. But life has a way of questioning your answers. And over the last 30 years, I've had to be deprogrammed from a lot of what I've learned. And perhaps in answer to your first question, why do I do what I do? It's to keep finding out what it is I don't know. And since there, you know, we journalists have a license to explain things we don't understand, and since there's a lot I don't understand, I'm just on a perpetual learning curve.
I want you to repeat that definition of a journalist, and then I'd like for you to tell that viewer what it's like to sit with someone, as I am sitting with you, someone who's had a vastly different set of experiences from mine. But you're sitting with people, whether it's in the Genesis conversations with world-renowned religious leaders, or a Joseph Campbell, or in all the other things that you've done with children and every other thing that you've done. How does it feel as a journalist to sit here talking to someone there when they know so much more than you do?
Well, it's very hard to do what you do. First of all, you have to keep me interested, and you have to keep me thinking. You have to be aware that all the time as you're talking to me, there's a virtual community out beyond that camera of several thousand, several million people, and you've got to hold their interest. And then you have real human beings here in the studio, and you've got to keep them engaged. You've got to think about what you know this person knows. At the same time, you have to listen to what he is saying so that when I get through, you don't just ask me a question that has already been in your mind and programmed irrespective of what I answer. If you're going to have a real conversation, we have to listen to what the person is saying and respond to that. America is full of talkers. Talk is cheap in America, but listening is rare, and conversation is rare. And real conversation grows out of not my regurgitating to you what I have already said on many, many occasions, but upon my listening to your question, responding to it, you're listening to my answer, and then following up. So it's a very, very difficult art that you're practicing on a high wire right there all the time. And at the same time, you can often forget all that's happening. You can forget the people in the audience, forget the million people behind the camera, and just get so engrossed in what we're talking about that the world closes out, and it's just the two of you in a very intimate setting. It works best when all of those things happen, but it is most pleasurable to me when the latter happens and the guest, my subject, forgets the lights, forgets the camera, forgets the programmed routine of all television and simply begins to engage me in a conversation that takes us deeper and deeper into an understanding of what we're talking about. That happens rarely, but when it does happen, it makes it worthwhile.
It's a special time, no doubt, when it does happen.
It's happened to me many times. I took Maya Angelou back to her hometown of Stamps, Arkansas, totally unrehearsed. None of my programs or yours are rehearsed. And we were in this little town, and she was telling me what it was like to grow up in Stamps, Arkansas, this little town, when it was divided by a railroad track, and blacks were invited across, blacks crossed that railroad track into the white part of town only by invitation. And it was a world threatening to a young black child growing up. And she would go across the railroad tracks to the little grocery store and buy the second day bread and take it back, and always subject to the epithets and the insults and the ugly things that might be said about a small child by some bully or something like that. We're just naturally walking down this road, and she said, it's right over there is where I used to go as a child, and right over beyond that tree was the store. And we got right close to the railroad track, and if you'll see this in the documentary, we start out walking side by side, but I'm just paying attention to what she's saying and looking off in the distance, and I'm about 10 feet in front of her, about 5 feet in front of her. And we get to the railroad tracks, and she says, and I'll tell you what, Bill, I can't even go over there now. And she turns me around, takes my elbow, turns me around, and I look at her and I say, I understand. And there was a moment of genuine understanding. She said, I'll tell you what, you stay on this side of the tracks and we'll both be okay. And we turn and walk off. It's a great moment in television.
Those moments are ones that you cherish, ones that keep coming back to you. And perhaps one of the moments or series of moments that I remember most is the series of conversations that you had with Mortimer Adler. Yeah. And you also walked with him. You talked about some of the great ideas. And I guess the question that I'd like to pose to you now is this. Of all those ideas, not just his, all the ideas that you've listened to over this time, are there one or two that stick out in your mind that that have made such an impact on you that you feel compelled to talk about it, or at least it has helped change you in some way?
Well, that's a good but a difficult question, because if I'd been asked that question 2 years ago, my answer would probably be different than it is today, because so much more has happened in the last 2 years. I mean, I guess it's the idea that everything is connected. And I really believe that. I really think that everything is connected, that at the moment of your passage, you can't see the connections, but that when you look back on your life, you see a pattern that was unfolding even as you couldn't recognize it at the moment, and that every event has a consequence. Most of those consequences are unintended, and life becomes a matter of dealing with the unintended consequences. But there is a connection. I mean, I never intended to work in the White House. It never entered my mind, but there I was. I didn't even know what television was. We didn't have television until I was in college. Over at North Texas, I saw the first television when they had a set in the Student Union Building. We watched the McCarthy hearings, the Senator Joe McCarthy hearings. I had no idea what television was. If anybody had said to me, "What are you preparing for?" and I said, "I'm preparing for a life in television," I mean, they would have hauled me off and had me arrested for deranged. You know, I had no idea. But yet,
there was hardly anything to television at that time.
One thing led to another. I debated with myself growing up, would I be a teacher, which had a strong appeal to me? Would I be a preacher? I grew up in a religious home in a wonderful Baptist church, and I thought that would be a great way to go. And I thought about politics. Lyndon Johnson once said to me later, many years later, there are three ways a poor boy from Texas could signify. One was to become a teacher, one was to become a preacher, one was to become a politician. Well, as it turns out, television is the natural environment for all of those interests. Politics, I've done many documentaries about politics. Religion, I've done many series about religion. And teaching, I have a classroom, the largest classroom I could ever have had. After I finished seminary, I'd been accepted to do my PhD at the University of Texas in American Civilization. I was going to study church and state issues. Well, I could never have had the classroom at the university where I wanted to teach that I've had on television. So somehow these unintended consequences, you know, someone said to me once, coincidence is God's way of remaining anonymous. And I think there's some truth to that, and I also think there's some truth to the notion that you are drawn irresistibly toward your innermost reality, toward your innermost yearning, and that the lucky among us, few though we are, find that yearning and that reality unfolding in our response to the unintended consequences.
A couple of years ago, you had a health problem, which you still have to take a little bit of care about. But about a year before that, you came to Dallas, you spoke at the Tate Lecture Series at SMU.
Oh, yes.
One of the things you said there, if I could paraphrase it a bit, you said that in your life, you still vacillate between trying to make a difference in the world, to try to change things, and yet another part of you pulls you, I think you use the word, into the snuggeries of self and home and family. How do you resolve those two things, and do you still vacillate?
Well, I'm still drawn, yes, torn between the desire to lead a quiet and personal life and read all those books that keep piling up, or now watch all those cassettes that keep piling up, and the desire to be out in the world like this and listening and learning and creating programs. I think that's, you know, it's a fortunate ambivalence in which to be caught, because most people don't have such options. But there are moments when I'm on the road, or as much as I'm enjoying something, when I really wish that I had my music on at home and or was sitting in front of the fire and reading. So yes, harder than not having any choices is having too many choices, because you always want, it's like that yellow, what was the poem Robert Frost wrote? Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and I not knowing took one.
Took the one least traveled.
Yes. I went, when I was, many years ago, I made my first visit to the cathedral at Chartres, Have you been there?
Yes, I have.
Magnificent Gothic street that just sort of pulls you out and focuses you on
the glass, the blue, the windows, and then something else got in hold of you, though. What was
and you pay your 6 francs to join the tour, and they talk, you walk around it with a little knot of people, and the tour guide is talking about this and talking about that. But I have always, in those places, broken off from the tour. I've gone off on my own. I guess that's why I'm a journalist. What is not being told to me that I am curious about? So I rounded the corner near the nave, and I came upon this sculpture. It was so stunning, it stopped me in my tracks. The artist depicts Adam, the first human, neither male nor female. There's no masculine or feminine form to the figure. Depicts Adam emerging as an idea from the side of God's head. God is literally thinking us, in the artist's imagination, thinking us into existence. And I remember standing, it was a seminal moment for me. I'd grown up comfortable in my little church, and where we had a theology that fit life's needs, and the Bible had the answers. I remember standing there thinking, you know, well, yeah, that's right. If we are in fact endowed in the image of the Creator, gifted with this incredible faculty for thought and reason and imagination, then we are destined, inevitably by our nature, the very reason water runs downhill, we are invested to debate the meaning of life, to argue with each other about what it all means, and to challenge not only the text, but God. I mean, how could God have created us not expecting us to challenge God, having invested us with free will and an instrument like the human mind? And that opened the way for me. It liberated me to keep asking questions and to keep challenging so that I'm never free to be restless. I'd like sometimes to be free to be restless. I'd like not to be so restless. Not so curious.
I understand, but I don't think you can change that. In fact,
no,
I don't think
you'd
even want to change it, except as you say, that once in a while, you'd like to say, you know, let me have a little bit of peace here.
That's the other thing you learn as you go along. I keep things that touch me in my little calendar here, and I just wrote down one the other day that helped explain me to me, which happens a lot of time. And it's Freud, and I was reading something about there's a TV show about him, and there was a review about it, and it quoted something he said. He said, a man could be a woman. A man should not strive to eliminate his complexes, but to get in accord with them. They are legitimately what directs his conduct in the world. And I said, yeah, that's right. That's me. I mean, I've been... People would say, well, Moyers is kind of Hamlet. He's kind of torn between doing this and doing that. You know, that's my complex. Okay, that's all right. I guess the other great idea that has impressed me a lot is the idea of coming to terms with yourself, of accepting that you will never know or never be all that you might have been or might have known. And that's all right. Accepting the contradictions and the mysteries of your own being is necessary to try to wrestle with the contradictions and the mysteries of God.
Well, and you've gotten involved so much in myths, and we sort of call this program The Man and His Myths, and the series with Joseph Campbell, of course, and in this series, the book that I'm holding here, Genesis, is the one that you've worked on most recently. Because of your background, you went to seminary school, as most people know. Why did you decide to do a program, 10 programs, a 10-part program, a book like this, for goodness sake, on the first chapter in the Bible?
You remember what I said about the editor of the first newspaper to bring an account of such considerable things has come to my attention? Yes. Well, I did that with Campbell. I had no great overriding mission with Joseph Campbell. I just heard that he was getting an award from the National Arts Club in New York, and I had remembered reading Hero of a Thousand Faces, his most famous book, many years ago. And I went and pulled it off my shelf. He was a little paragraph in the New York Times said he's going to receive this award. So I went down and heard him. He was a marvelous lecture, and I thought, gee, he'd be a good interview. And out of that came the Campbell series. Genesis was not an original idea of mine. I don't mean the book. I didn't write the book. But in fact, I've always wanted to produce a book whose jacket would read, between these covers is an earthy saga of violence, murder, jealousy, betrayal, envy, lust, and talking snakes. But Mother wouldn't let me, and God got there first, and all I did was to make a television series based on the book. Yeah. Right. Anyway, again, I read in the paper a story of a reporter who'd been there before me talking about a Genesis seminar being conducted at the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York, not far from where I live. It said this is the best conversation in New York. So I thought, well, I love the world of ideas. I'm a journalist covering ideas. My beat is ideas, the way some reporters cover the courthouse. So I called up the rabbi and said, could I come and sit in? He said, yes, come ahead. I went up, Rabbi Burton Vasovsky, he's in all 10 of the programs, you'll read him in the book. He had started this seminar 4 or 5 years before out of a conviction that many Christians and many Jews were neglecting the masterwork of their faith, the Bible. And he also thought that the Bible truly comes alive when we talk about it and discuss it together. Sure, you can get something out of reading it alone, but when people talk about it, sharing their responses to it, talking about their different stories, another voice enters the room, the voice of the book, a third voice, a fifth voice if there are 4 of you, a 10th voice if there are 9 of you. The book has a voice. And so he brought together novelists, playwrights, poets, ordinary laity, biblical scholars, both Christians and Jews, and they were working their way word by word. They would sometimes spend a whole 3-hour evening on one word in the Hebrew text. Story by story, they were going right through the Bible. And it was fascinating. There was a moment I was sitting there, and they're talking about the call of Abraham. God summons Abraham and says, go to Canaan, and I'll make you the father of a great nation. And Max Apple, the novelist who teaches at Rice University in Houston, Max Apple spoke up and said, I wouldn't have written it that way. Well, they reacted the way our folks here are reacting.
Of course.
And Max Apple was a little sheepishly said, no, no. He said, to know the reward before you leave is no test of faith. And as Burt Vasovsky later said to me, this was not only a valuable commentary on the text, but it was also a liberating moment for the participants, because they felt freed to approach the text from their own experience and to challenge the text. And that's really the way, as I said earlier about the experience of Shirt, that I think God wants us to approach these texts.
One of the things that I like about what you did with the book is that you actually came out with a guide as well, a guide that says, let's put this together in some way, shape, or form, and let's talk to people about it. Let's get groups together to talk about the issues that are going on. Do you think possibly that people will actually get together in small groups, in their living room, as an example, and talk about these issues, look at them in a different way, and explore these things back and forth as you had a chance to do?
They have. We put together our own seminar for the PBS series after I'd been up to the Jewish Theological Seminary. We got 8 people to come together from different faiths and persuasions and talk. We recorded. That was the series that we put on the air. At the same time, my wife Judith, who is from Dallas, an educator, now my partner, was responsible for an enormous outreach. We went out to over 100 different groups and said, what happens on television mustn't end when the television program is over. We want people to enjoy this discussion. You know, when I was growing up in East Texas, Baptists talked about the Bible with other Baptists, Methodists with other Methodists, Presbyterians with other Presbyterians, but never the twain met. I grew up in a town 50% white, 50% black, but the black Christians and the white Christians never got together to talk about their different perceptions of the Bible. So we went out with 100 organizations and said to people all over the country, start a discussion group. We published the little resource guide that goes with the companion book, and we said, don't just do it with people who are like you, of the same faith, the same stripe, the same color, the same ethnicity. Get different people together. And somewhere over between 2,000 or 3,000 discussion groups were reading the book, using the resource guide, watching the series, and talking about it. And when the series is repeated this year, 1997, on PBS stations all over the country, including KERA and KDNT. Those discussion groups will meet again, and new ones will form. The series made the cover of Time magazine, the cover of Newsweek International, the cover of USA Weekend. I've never had as much advance media attention to any series because people are yearning to talk about something that really signifies like this.
You don't know this, but because I haven't told you this, and just the times, a couple of times that you and I have met, but when you were doing the Mortimer Adler series on, I can't remember all the great truth, but justice, beauty, truth, the three I can recall off the top of my head, we used to do that around my television set. We taped the program off, played it, it's an hour tape, and then talked about it for 2 or 3 hours. And that sort of an experience. The thing today is, do people have the time? I mean, it's so valuable.
You have to make the time. I mean, I did a series a few years ago on PBS, 15 years ago, called A Walk Through the 20th Century. And I promoted it by, it was my personal view of the 20th century, 17 different episodes. And I promoted it by saying to families, to people, to viewers, get your grandmother and your grandchildren, your extended family in the same room and talk about each episode. Watch the episode on the 1920s. I used my mother and father as sort of seminal characters in that. They were married in 1926. They had a hard life during the Depression. They picked cotton. And then I told around that with archival footage what was happening in the country. And I said, you know, very rarely do grandmothers and grandfathers stop and tell their grandchildren what life was like in their time or ask their grandchildren what life is like. I had more letters. They're prized letters of mine today from families that watched that series together and then talked about it. Dennis, the measure of television is not the number of people who watch, but the imprint left on those who do watch. And the conversation the next morning at the breakfast table, the carpool, the water around the water cooler, at the coffee break, or at lunch. If television does, if we just watch television passively and are somewhat amused by it or entertained, that's all right for a while. But the fact of the matter is you've spent an hour of your life in that solitary isolation from anyone else, and you take nothing away from there but an hour spent. It's a moral transaction. When somebody gives you an hour of your time, you want to make sure you give them something in exchange because they don't ever get that hour back. Well, and conversation does it.
Yeah, that's a great way to look at it. And I think that one of the most meaningful things is when people call us and say, not only we bought a tape of this program, but we're playing it in the classroom, or it's in Connecticut, a professor in Connecticut called recently, or here at SMU, or any other place around the country, that they use that as a teaching tool. It's probably because, you know, same way with yours, I mean, we have such incredible people on this program as you do on yours, they would never be able to meet those people one-on-one, and yet they get their ideas.
After the Adler series, which ran in 1980, I mean, you were just in college then, I'm sure. But anyway,
yes, thank you. Thank
I
you
had
much.
A letter from an elderly lady, 80-some-odd years old, in Toledo, Ohio, and she said, all my life I wished to have had Mortimer Adler as my guest in my living room. I couldn't. I read his books early. I knew about him. But I'm housebound. I'm crippled. It's cold in here. And I don't know people like that. I would never have had Mortimer Adler as my guest. But he's been in my home every Sunday afternoon for the last 6 weeks as my personal guest because of PBS.
I think that's a great story. I'm going to tell you just one quick thing, and I'm going to ask this young man to make his comment or ask you a question. But it's kind of strange, my wife and I work together as you and your wife do, and we were in a convention one time, and a very attractive young lady ran up to me, and she said, you were in my living room. In fact, you were in my bedroom with me last Sunday. And Nikki is standing there going, yes? And she was in New York City, coincidentally, and the program was playing that morning when she and her husband were lying in bed, and I was in bed with them, figuratively speaking. And that really got to me. Obviously, she explained it carefully to Nikki first, I might tell you. But that's the kind of thing that we don't think about sometimes if we're standing here in front of these cameras.
Mr. Moyers, I didn't realize I came here today to ask you this question, but it's one that's been in my mind for quite a while, and you're the guy to answer it. And that is, we've been talking about conversation, education, wisdom, learning, growing, that interaction that occurs between people that causes new thought to come into place. And I've noticed over the last years that education for me has moved from studying to learn things to now when I'm exposed to stuff, it's like I already knew it. It's a reawakening on stuff that I never had a conscious thought about, never was able to language before, but now it comes into my world as a truth that I already knew. The question is, have you noticed any of that sort of a change and over the last 20 or 30 years of your education?
Well, the root meaning of the word in Latin, educare, means to draw out, to bring forth, to summon. And education is a summoning of what is inherent often. It's not just pumping information and knowledge into a brain. It's helping the person to use that inner faculty that we come equipped with, like our intelligence. And if you also accept the whole connectedness of the DNA concept, that so much is transmitted in that microscopic organism that becomes the new life, that it's there and unfolds. I mean, it's interesting that with my children, when they were 4 or 5 years old, we had 3 children, and one of them would do something at the table, reach over and get the last piece of watermelon. And the other one would say, "That's not fair." Now, we had not set our children down and talked to them about concepts of fairness, equity, or justice. Where did they know this? I mean, it was there. The situation drew it out of them, this inherent awareness that something was not fair. Yes, I agree that we come equipped like great invisible reservoirs that need to be tapped so that with the relationship, with a conversation with people who know things we don't know or haven't yet articulated, there is a dance that takes place that from which new understanding emerges.
Thanks.
Mr. Moyers, there's a portion of Genesis that I've always found curious and particularly telling, and that's after Adam and Eve have eaten of the tree of knowledge, and the serpent and God are having a conversation, he says, "Now I must basically kick them out of the garden, because if not, they'll eat of the tree of life and be as gods, be like us as gods." And I find that a curious passage, and how do the different authors deal with that?
Well, we have quite a spirited discussion about that in the television show and in the book, which is 4 times the amount of information in the television show, because we taped 4 or 5 hours for every session, edited it down for television, and I put all the discussion in the book. And there are various interpretations of that. That's the great, and one interpretation is just as valid as the other if it's reasonable and grounded. And there are various interpretations of that. I've always felt considerable sympathy for Eve. I think Eve got a bum rap. She looked at that piece of fruit, presumably an apple, possibly an apple, and God had said, if you eat it, you'll become like us, gods. Who's the us, for example? We don't really know who the us is referred to in the text. But so the fruit had knowledge, offered knowledge. It clearly was attractive, beautiful, so it offered beauty. And it was delicious to eat, apparently, so it offered pleasure. And so all Eve wanted was pleasure, knowledge, and beauty. What's wrong with that? And she was just expressing this natural curiosity of someone to reach for a beautiful, pleasurable, knowledgeable object. And for that, she gets kicked out and according to the story, punished with the labor of childbirth ever thereafter. I mean, these stories have been the source of a lot of mischief as well as the source of a lot of illumination. I don't know what it really means. Maybe it says something about boundaries, that you can want too much pleasure, too much knowledge, too much beauty, or you can overreach in striving for them and meet a catastrophe. But I don't know. People think that because I have all these people on, I know the Bible. I mean, I'm a journalist. It's because I don't know answers to questions like that I do what I do. They think that I know everything about mythology because I interviewed one of the country's leading mythologists. I don't. I'm a facilitator, and I have to really resist people who want me to become their authority.
Yeah, and sometimes the best you can do is to try to somehow explain what somebody else said about that as best you can recall it.
You know, when I was growing up, I almost ruined my voice trying to imitate the cry of Tarzan as he swung on that vine from one tree to another to the rescue of his distressed mate, Jane, hollering bloody murder all the time. You remember that cry. Well, what did we learn a few years ago? That Johnny Weissmuller and Buster Crabbe didn't make that noise. It was a recording of three men, a baritone, a tenor, and a hog caller from Arkansas. Now, what's the point? The point is the world is hard on believers. It really is. And my life has been spent coping with the fact that the world didn't fit the way at 12 or 18 or 24 I thought it was. This world is hard on believers.
Two things. One, what, if any, background did you ever have in economics as you were preparing for yourself as a journalist? That's one of the things that I see a lot of journalists who didn't do a lot of. From your perspective, did you do a lot of economics, or have you since?
I've done some, always with trepidation, because it strikes one as an arcane field, and it's long been, like the Bible, kept to the preserve of the experts, so that you have to feel you have to go into some temple, Federal Reserve temple, and talk to the oracles about the economics. And it's true that there are some, it is somewhat arcane, but yet I guess the only economics I learned was in trying to make a living and save my money and buy a house and pay the mortgage and balance my account and realize if I saved and invested here, I got this much back. If I saved and invested there, I got this much back. If I saved and speculated, I almost got nothing back. And it's a matter of learning, trial and error. I think the experts tend to make all of these subjects esoteric for the general public, when really basic common sense about economics is the best approach for a good journalist to take.
My friend, economics professor Steve Pejovich, defines economics as the study of human behavior in a world of scarcity. Now, you have seen human behavior, the good, the bad, and sometimes the ugly. You have, I think, in the short time we have left, some opinions about individualism versus more of a community. Talk to us about that.
Well, let me just say for one thing, my best lesson in economics came from my 16-year-old son, who asked me for an increase in his allowance. And I said, Cope, don't you know there are some things in this world more important than money? He said, yes, Dad, but it takes money to date them. that was the best lesson that I had in economics. Dennis, generalizations I find generally wrong. And it's a mistake to draw generalizations about individual human beings. I find some human beings, individual human beings, absolutely a delight. And I find some so insufferable that I have to maintain my best Southern courtesy in order to tolerate them. I mean, I do that. But I do think there's something incredibly wondrous about each of us. Troubling. But wondrous too, our capacity to imagine, our capacity for love, our capacity, although not altogether ever realized, for intimacy. That's so many, we pass through so many experiences and that we connect with so many people. I mean, there's just something incredibly stunning about the human persona and the human personality. And yet I do think that this notion of the rugged individual has been much overplayed in our society. John Wayne was not really a cowboy, and Ronald Reagan was not really a hero. They were actors, and you didn't make it in on the frontier as an individual. You had to help your neighbor raise their barn. You had to help a neighbor care for her sick. My father, before he died, we sat on the porch in Marshall, Texas, and he talked about how when that great plague came through North Texas and Southern Oklahoma in the 1918, he lost, 16 and 18, he lost his father. Neighbors washed the body, neighbors dug the grave, and neighbors helped bury my grandfather. And my father, even up until almost the end of his life, and the members of the Central Baptist Church would sit up all night beside the corpse of a church member who had died at the funeral home there. And I said to him one time, why did you do that? You had to get up the next morning, 6 o'clock, and drive a truck all day. I would often hear my father come in from the funeral home where he had been in attendance of the corpse at 5 or 5:30 in the morning, take a bath, get up, and then get up and drive off and go to drive. Why did you do that? He said. I said. And he said, well, he looked at me as if I were naive, silly. He said, it's just the thing we did. The thing we did. You know, it struck me not long ago that all of my life I've prayed the Lord's Prayer, but I've never prayed, "Give me this day my daily bread." It has always been, "Give us this day our daily bread." And when I think about the very process by which bread comes to my table, I don't own a farm. I know nothing about growing wheat. I know nothing about processing bread. I just go down to a store and buy delicious bread. And somebody raised that wheat. Somebody brought it to market. Somebody processed it. Somebody packaged it, and somebody delivered it. Life is a, civilization is a whole chain of mutual accountability. "Give us this day our daily bread" is the greatest reminder to me of civilization.
Our ability to bring that person into what we're talking about and connect with them is so important. On behalf of everyone watching, everyone here, Bill Moyers, the man and his myths, we appreciate your being here. And I don't think I need to say anything else. We've been talking about things that matter with a person who really cares. Thank you for joining us.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.